It's a challenge to be a token economist on a panel, especially when I'm the only thing between you and lunch. So I'll try to make it worth your while. I don't guarantee I'm going to teach you anything new, but I can guarantee that you will live longer for having sat through my talk. So don't get up and run for the exit just yet. You listen to economists talk for 30 minutes and you'll think it lasted forever. My task today is to speak about farm-level decision tools. What can you use to analyze investments in agricultural technology? That's not an easy task because the basis of these is in formal decision analysis or decision theory. And decision analysis requires a fair amount of understanding of economics, mathematics, and statistics. And I'm not going to go through that today because rather than extend your lives, I'd kill you from boredom. But the basic model comes down to, we assume that everyone is rational, the economist rational man. And that's a much maligned point of view, and it describes no one in the world, but we use it in our decision modeling to say, here's where we could be if we were perfectly rational. We know decision making is messy. Emotions interfere with rational processing. You know, in marketing, we've talked about greed, hope, and fear marketing since marketing was invented, right? Greed, hope, and fear, all emotions. And I'm just going to ask you about what you think about some personal decisions that some individuals have made and whether or not you think they're rational. My faith tells me I can't judge these people. I won't. But as an economist, I'll judge their decision-making process. You know, if either one of these showed up at your feedlot and asked you for a job, if you're one of our animal product companies here, would you want either one of these people to be the face of your company? You know, if they showed up wanting a job, going out and working with producers, trying to sell them from you, you probably wouldn't be too interested in hiring them. By the way, according to the website where I pulled these photos off of, the gentleman in the photo there is a university professor, and I was just going to ask Bob if this fellow worked with him at Mizzou's animal science department. Not sure. By the way, Kansas? See the Jayhawk? Okay. You know, I swear if you took Bob's glasses off and shaved what's left of his hair, there's an awful striking similarity there. So the bottom line is emotions do play a role. We're going to have to take those out of the equation, though, when we do look at decision making. We have to assume them away, even though we know they enter the calculus that individuals make. As I said, we're going to quickly dispense with decision theory as something that we can use on farm. Too mathematically complex. It involves more information than we can readily collect. We need joint probability distributions over joint events, probability distribution. And getting that information when we've got more than one or two random events, we can't do it. It just doesn't work. And some events are what we call ambiguous. They're not risky, they're ambiguous. Risk is we know what the possible outcomes are, and we know what the probability of them occurring or what the likelihood of them occurring will be. When something's ambiguous, we don't know what the possible outcomes are, and we can't assess the likelihoods of those outcomes. And so decision theory doesn't work well in the real world. And there's a slug of published criticism of it. I'm going to just move on. What I'm going to lay out in all the tools that I'm going to talk about, you've probably seen before. I'm sure everyone in the room has seen the tools before. I'm going to lay out three criteria that you may have not thought about putting these decisions and decision tools necessarily in the same context. And those criteria, first, it's relative scale. So how big is this decision relative to a person's net worth? Perceived risk. How risky does the individual perceive this decision to be? And degree of reversibility. And how easily can this measures how easily can the decision be undone? Are we stuck with this forever or for a long period of time? Or will it be very, very costly to undo the decision? And so when I talk about the tools, I'm going to talk about them relative to these three criteria, and it might provoke some thought that you haven't necessarily put them in this context before. So let me talk about relative scale for a moment. And each one of these, I'll lay out an example how the scale affects. So in my first example, I've got a 3,000-acre U.S. soybean producer considering switching 160 acres to a new variety. You know, this is a relatively small-scale decision. Alternatively, if we think about a subsistence farmer, say maybe in Africa, they've got 10 acres, and they're thinking about switching 5 acres to a new variety. Relatively, that's a large-scale decision. And so we're going to spend more time, we would think, on the large-scale decisions. We're going to use more sophisticated tools on that large-scale decision rather than on that small-scale decision. And scale matters because it is related to our ability to take and survive risks should an adverse outcome occur. Perceived risk. I'm not going to go into it, but there is a difference between perceived risk and actual risk. A lot of you, if any of you had money invested in the stock market when the market busts, you were like, how could it go down? It's always gone up. Your perception of what risk was as opposed to the reality is something different. But perceived risk is how we make decisions, and so that's why we include it into our decision-making criteria. So risk, perceived risk is how does the decision-maker, what do they believe the potential adverse outcomes of a decision are, and what's the likelihood of them? And these need to be weighed relative to what's the potential upside. We heard about some retained ownership programs. There's risk there, right? We could lose those cattle. They could get sick. They could die. The price of the cattle could fall. There's risk there. Why might somebody do it? Because of the potential upside. All right, so back to our example, our 3,000-acre soybean producer. Probably could survive a low yield on that 160 acres. He's familiar with soybean production. There's markets available for this variety. Pretty low risk investment decision. In the second example where we had that subsistence farmer, you know, a low yield in his case on that just 5 acres might mean he doesn't feed his family. You know, half his kids might starve to death. This is a high risk, relatively high risk investment decision. Degree of reversibility. This is one that even as economists, we often overlook. And it's really important because what it comes down to is options have value. And when you start cutting off options, you're reducing value or increasing cost. So the bottom line is we ask, can the decision be undone in a relatively low-cost, short time frame? So we heard a little bit about how protein supplementation and how that affects weaning weight. Hey, that's a decision that can be undone very quickly, right? Very, very reversible. If I don't want to feed those cows those cubes anymore in the winter, I don't want to put a lick tub out, reversible almost instantaneously. The decision in this country to move to black-hided cattle, that's a fairly irreversible decision, low degree of reversibility. Not that we can't undo it, but if we do decide to do it, it's going to incur a lot of cost and a lot of time. You're either going to have to go out, sell all your cows and bulls, and buy new ones that are a different hide color, or you're going to have to breed it in over several generations, right? This is low degree of reversibility. I'm not saying that wasn't a rational decision, just putting it in this context that that's fairly irreversible. Reversibility, as I mentioned, is what we call a real option. And just as with commodity options, puts and calls, options have value. So we can go out today, you can jump on your electronic trading account right now and buy and sell puts and calls. You can buy and sell puts and calls that we say are out of the money. That is, they're not likely to pay off, but yet you still pay something for them or somebody pays you for them if you're selling them. And that's because they create an option down the road that might have value. Same thing with reversibility. It might have value in the future. So when we look at technology investment, sometimes we might invest in a technology that doesn't look like it's going to pay off, but it creates an option that might pay off down the road. And I'm going to talk more about this later, but let's think about a decision by a seed stock producer to test and select or use marker-assisted selection for tenderness. What incentive right now does that seed stock producer have to select based on tenderness? There's no markets that are rewarding that, at least no large-scale markets that I'm aware of. So it would appear that this is not a wise decision. But that investment creates flexibility. So if 5 years from now a chain opens up that says we are going to pay for some process verification for tenderness that includes genetics, this guy's all set up to pump out breeding stock that has the right markers. That has value. That option to do that has value. Now, I'm not saying that you guys should when you run out to lunch, say, you know, that idiot up there, economist, was saying we should all go out and select for tenderness. I'm using it as an example of why we might invest in technology. It creates an option. All right. So as I said, as a decision increases in relative scale, perceived risk, and degree of reversibility, or more importantly, degree of irreversibility, decision tools need to be more sophisticated, and that means more information. So I'm going to run through some of these tools quickly. You've all seen them before, but I'm going to put them in this context that we're talking about, these three criteria. So here's the tools. You've seen them all. These are the only ones, really, that we have for on-farm decision-making right now. And that's unfortunate. The bottom one is the one that we need to be using, particularly when we're talking about genetic selection, and it's the one we don't have any tools right now for on-farm. All right, partial budgeting. We've all done this before, I presume. You've probably all seen this before. These are for small-scale, low-risk, highly reversible decisions. I've got my soybean example up here. So what we do is we look at just the changes on farm. We look at how does revenue increase versus decrease, cost increase versus decrease. We don't look at the things that don't change. You don't see in there anything like crop, the land rent. It doesn't matter. We rent the land either way, so in a partial budget, we only look at those items that are changing. Enterprise budget. We're going to use this for somewhat larger scale and a low to moderate risk decision. For example, if we're comparing two competing enterprises, we might be comparing here retained ownership versus selling at weaning. Those are examples where we'd use enterprise budgets. They're also useful for doing break-even analysis, so we can start considering what's the impact of adverse outcomes. So we say, what's the likelihood that I'm not going to get that break-even sale price? And there's lots of, just about everybody in here, your state has budgets on these things. Your state cooperative extension service has local budgets. If not, at the end of this thing, I'm going to put up the website for Minnesota's got a national library of them. that you can go grab those. Whole farm budgeting. So here what we're going to do is we're going to compile all those enterprise budgets together to build a whole farm budget. So this is fairly large-scale decisions we might look at here as opposed to the smaller ones. For example, an investment in livestock feeding facilities is the type of scale that we'd look at with this tool. Risk and reversibility are informally considered. We're going to ask what-if type questions. What if costs are 25% higher? What if my health costs on these cattle are higher? What if I got to liquidate the investment? So we can start looking at some of these reversibility decisions. And as you guys know, when you start putting money into a single-use facility like a feedlot or backgrounding lot, you can't pick them up and move them to a different location. And they've got one use. So if you're going to sell them, you've got to sell them to somebody that wants to be there and own that type of facility. And so usually when we, you know, when we put them down as an investment, we write off 50% of the construction cost right off the top on our balance sheet. Market value is 50% of what we invested in it. This is an example of how irreversibility affects the whole farm. Cash flow budgeting, I'm not going to say anything about it, because no matter what you do, regardless of scale, risk, or reversibility, you got to do it. Everybody's got to do this regardless, unless you got big money. And most of our producers aren't in that category. But all we're going to do in this case is the focus isn't on profitability or advisability, it's on feasibility. Can we do this? Does it cash flow? And so all we look at are sources and uses of cash. Capital budgeting. This is another place where we do too little of this on farm. Capital budgeting, we use this primarily for assets that are longer lived. And so when we're looking at doing investment in new breeding stock, this is the tool we ought to be using. And too often we're back using either partial budgeting or enterprise budgeting, and this is what the tool we really should be doing. It considers the time value of money, and it considers the long-lived nature of certain assets. Again, though, we can't formally look at risk and reversibility. We got to do those what-if type questions with this modeling framework. And so with this framework, almost everybody in here is familiar with the concept of an annuity. Pays you a fixed amount over time. We can take these assets, take their cash flow streams, convert them into what's a net present value, and then into this annualized equivalent, an annuity. If you got a constant payment, this is what it would be worth. And so this is useful, particularly when we want to compare assets that have different lives, different lengths of time that we're going to look at them. And so you might be looking at a set of genetics in a cow, but it does affect longevity. We've heard that earlier today. But it has other beneficial results. Maybe they end up with higher weaning weights. Maybe their maintenance energy is lower. How do we compare that cow then with the cow that lives longer but has the higher maintenance energy? Because if we were to just sum up the cash flows coming from them, the cow that's got the longer life always looks like she's going to be the winner. But if I'm replacing that lower maintenance energy cow more rapidly than the other one, that also has value. And so we have to aggregate those up. And capital budgeting is the way that we can do that. We can convert those cash flow streams into an annual equivalent to compare them. Okay. Real option pricing is where we need to be for most. My phone keeps doing that. Get it away from the microphone. If we're looking at genetic selection, this is where we probably need to be. This is the tool that we really ought to be looking at. We're not. Economists haven't done this yet. We just aren't there. And remember that issue about complexity and information requirements? The reason we haven't done this is the information requirements here are too burdensome for us to make on-farm tools readily available. And so we just haven't done it. In fact, I did a literature search to see if I could find anybody that's done used this tool, even in the academic realm. I can't find anybody that's been there yet. Having said that, there's only about 3 agricultural economists that have published applied studies on genetics, on genetic markers, I should say, one of them is my colleague Jason Lusk at Oklahoma State. I've published a few articles on it, and then David Lambert, who's now at Kansas State, former colleague of mine when I was at North Dakota State, has a published study. So as you can see, there's not much out there right now by economists looking at how do markers, individual markers or marker panels, affect profitability at any one point in the production system. So we're in our infancy on the economic side. You guys, you geneticists here are much farther down the road. A big part of it is we're not trained at all in genetics, just like you guys have minimal training in economics. Most of us had a freshman biology class or something like that, and very little on genetics. And as you know, language creates a barrier to entry. And so when we start talking about single nucleotide polymorphisms, most economists are going to glaze over and they're not going to be real interested in what you have to say because they just don't understand it. And so we've got a language barrier to work on before we get there. This is the tool we really need to be using, though, and I hope that in the near future we get there, we start getting there and in the academic realm, and then we can start building the tools that will go out to be used on farm in the future. I've got a very, very sharp young man working with me right now. He hasn't started this paper yet, but part of his PhD dissertation, I'm going to have him build this framework, and maybe we can start working on that. All right. So just a little bit on the tools on the shelf. As I mentioned, if your state, not all states are publishing budgets anymore. Their extension services aren't publishing budgets. That's a victim of the cutbacks that have occurred over successive generations. There's the National Budget Library, which is housed at University of Minnesota's Digital Center. I've put some examples up there from OSU. If you go to beefextension.com, and we've got a list of tools up there for just about every segment in the on the production side. Those are Oklahoma-based budgets, but they would apply to a lot of states with minimal modification. And I've put some examples up here simply because I was involved with some of those programs. All right. Before I open up to questions, I want to go back to our first couple speakers. I really enjoyed the talks, the talk about the system approach and looking at economically relevant traits. Just some few thoughts on that. As we talk about beef improvement, one area that I think too often we forget is where is the new source of money to the beef channel? There's only one new source of money because most of what we're doing is we're trading money between ourselves, right? I go buy seed stock from you and you get semen from another seed stock. You buy my feeder calves. The only place where money's coming in is from the consumer end. And so beef improvement, ultimately, the ultimate goal, needs to be improving economics and comparing trade-offs, but we can't ignore that other end of the channel because it's the only place where we're getting new dollars into our system. They're the only place where they give us the money to go out and buy the new pickup. And so as we're analyzing these genetic discoveries, unraveling these mysteries, I think that ultimately where we have to head is on a system approach where we look at how does adopting a set of markers at one point not only affects a feedlot profitability, but then we look up and down the chain. If we select for these markers, what's that going to do to our end product? You know, if we find a set of markers that were to cut feedlot costs in half, but reduces our consumers' demand for that product because somehow it reduces quality, that's a trade-off that we need to be looking at. Or if we went back up the chain and those markers affect longevity or heifer pregnancy rate adversely, again, it's a trade-off that we need to be analyzing, and the only way we can do that is economics. I know you didn't want to hear that, but as an economist, I got to beat the drum for my discipline a little bit. So as you're building your studies, your genetic studies, I hope that you'll go knock on the economist's door down the hall from you and floor below you, building next door, wherever it's at, and talk to them about how you can collect data that will be useful with them as well. So, okay, with that, I'm going to leave it open for questions. We've got a few moments. I put my contact information up there. Feel free to email me and tell me how full of it I was. And